Hi, I'm Zakiya Dalila Harris. I'm the author of The Other Black Girl, coming out June 1st, 2021 from Atria Books.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I write narrative nonfiction about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia and the upcoming book When Women Invented Television.
Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends, brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Thanks for joining us for our first episode. On this show, we'll be discussing important American authors featured in the museum, examining the ways their work and their lives are relevant in light of current culture, issues, discussions, and literature. We're both authors and fans of literary history, and we can't wait to bring these authors to life through a modern lens. For each episode, we'll start at the end of the story, our dead writers' obituaries.
New York Times, February 5th, 1960. Fort Pierce, Florida. Zora Neale Hurston, author, died in obscurity and poverty on January 28th, it was reported today. Her age was 57. She was working on a book entitled The Life of Herod the Great when she suffered a stroke almost a year ago. She died in Fort Pierce Memorial Hospital. Miss Hurston was among the foremost writers of Negro folklore in the United States. Her 8 books and numerous short stories and articles in magazines were well received by the critics. If she did not achieve a commercial success, that was the fault of the reading public, not Miss Hurston, the critics felt. Her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road, published in 1942, was described by John Chamberlain in the New York Times as saucy, defiant, high pressure, as vivid as a poinsettia, as beautiful as jasmine, and as vulgar as a well-liquored fish fry. In that book, Miss Hurston reiterated that the race question always left her completely unmoved. She said she never felt bitterness at being born a Negro, nor had she ever suffered from severe discrimination. Indeed, in New York, she was the sacred black cow of the social register crowd, she said.
New York Times, May 23rd, 1967. Langston Hughes, the noted writer of novels, stories, poems, and plays about Negro life, died last night in Polyclinic Hospital at the age of 65. Mr. Hughes was sometimes characterized as the O. Henry of Harlem. He was an extremely versatile and productive author who was particularly well known for his folksy humor. In a description of himself written for 20th Century Authors, a biographical dictionary, Mr. Hughes wrote, "My chief literary influences have been Paul Laurence Dunbar, Carl Sandburg, and Walt Whitman. My favorite public figures include Jimmy Durante, Marlena Dietrich, Mary McLeod Bethune, Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Marian Anderson and Henry Armstrong. I live in Harlem, New York City," his autobiographical sketch continued. "I am unmarried. I like Tristan, Goat's Milk, short novels, lyric poems, heat, simple folk, boats, and bullfights. I dislike Aida, parsnips, long novels, narrative poems, cold, pretentious folk, buses, and bridges." In one of his many anecdotes, Mr. Hughes explained how he became a poet when he was named class poet in grammar school in Lincoln, Illinois. "I was a victim of a stereotype," he observed wryly. "There were only 2 of us Negro kids in the whole class, and our English teacher was always stressing the importance of rhythm in poetry. Well, everyone knows, except us, that all Negroes have rhythm, so they elected me class poet. I felt I couldn't let my white classmates down, and I've been writing poetry ever since."
Our guest today is Yuval Taylor, author of Zora and Langston, A Story of Friendship and Betrayal.
The book was a finalist for the 2019 Los Angeles Times Book Prize in Biography. And it is the dramatic and moving story of one of the most influential friendships in literature.
So just to share a few highlights of the book with you, Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes were friends, collaborators, and among the leading literati of the Harlem Renaissance. Hurston, the author of Their Eyes Were Watching God, and Hughes, the author of The Negro Speaks of Rivers and Let America Be America Again, first met in 1925. They shared a patron, Charlotte Osgood Mason, a white woman who called herself Godmother. They took a formative road trip together, driving Hurston's car through the rural South as she collected folklore.
They eventually and faithfully worked on a script for the play Mulebone. Whether over Mason, Mulebone, jealousy, miscommunication, or all of the above, Hurston and Hughes had a subsequent falling out that was bitter and devastating. Taylor's work delves into the entire affair, illuminating the two writers' personal lives, personalities, conflicting ambitions, philosophies on race in America, and complicated relationships to their patron. And we both really enjoyed this book and found that we learned so much about them and their relationship that we did not learn in school. This was not in any of the lessons we learned in lit class or otherwise about them. And I think that that is one of the most fun aspects of this book, is kind of learning both about their relationship and also kind of, I love when I learn about how these big authors you admire and like seem like this distant thing, you realize they're just messy people like the rest of us.
Yes, I totally agree. And I found this book's discussion of the responsibility of the Black artist so fascinating too. It called to my mind the ever-present question within the Black community of what the best way to spur progress for Black people is. There's the disagreement between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois regarding whether Black people should work within the boundaries of white supremacy or directly fight against it. But this disagreement is also happening today, right? I mean, I also remember Cornel West's claims a couple years ago that Ta-Nehisi Coates fetishizes white supremacy and has a preoccupation with white acceptance. So it's a dichotomy that's still really relevant, still really present today, and it was interesting to see it play out in this book in regards to Zorin Langston and how their art was perceived by the world. So we'll get into all of this and more with the author, Yuval Taylor.
So welcome to Dead Writer Drama, Yuval Taylor. So we are so excited to talk to you about your book, which is about essentially, you know, it's not just a typical biography. This is specifically centering on this friendship and then ultimate falling out between Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes. They were great friends until they began collaborating on the script for a play that was eventually called Mulebone. Can you give us an overview of this story and how things went so wrong for them?
Okay, kind of a summing up of the entire book, huh?
Yes.
Well, Zora and Langston were two of the principal figures of the Harlem Renaissance, and together they cultivated an aesthetic that put African American folk language and stories at the center of literary production, and that was something that was somewhat new. I mean, there had been previous authors who had focused on that as well, like Charles Chestnut, but at the time they were the most extreme in terms of trying to create a purely African American art that owed nothing to white literary production. So they became really good friends they met in 1925. So from 1925 to 1927, they were at the heart of Harlem literary culture. They collaborated on a magazine called Fire that was published by Wallace Thurman, another Harlem Renaissance writer. And they shared a lot of tales and stories. And then in 1927, they took a road trip through the South together. And that was they had this coincidental meeting in Mobile, Alabama. Neither of them knew that the other was there. They just happened to meet on the street. And then they embarked on this road trip together that was so much fun. They had such a great time. And that really cemented their friendship. And they became really close friends. And then at around the same time, they were under the wing of a wealthy, very elderly white philanthropist named Charlotte Mason, who bankrolled them very lavishly and had them both under contract. And she had a rather pernicious influence on their work for the few years that they were under her thumb. So they bonded also not just over what they'd been doing, but also over how to deal with Charlotte Mason, and helped each other a lot in dealing with this capricious patron of theirs. Then they started collaborating on Mule Bone. Langston at that point had stopped writing poetry, and Zora was feeling very frustrated that she couldn't publish her work because Mason controlled it. And she was collecting all these folk tales and stories from the South, but none of it was getting out there. So they thought that the best way to get their ideas out at that point would be through the theater. And they both were very theatrical types. Zora had already written a number of short plays. Langston was completely enamored of the theater. His mother had been very involved in theater. So this was going to be the kind of a way out, a kind of a way to finally express themselves in the medium that they felt held the most value. And it also would be a great career move because this play was going to go to Broadway and it was going to make them, make them big stars, basically. There had been a tremendous number of Black productions on Broadway in the 20s. Shuffle Along had started it in 1921, but it had continued, and the biggest play on Broadway at that point was The Green Pastures, which was with an all-Black cast. So they felt that there was a lot of potential for Mule Bone. Mule Bone was based on a short story called The Bone of Contention that Zora had written in 1925, and it hewed quite closely to the plot of that story. And it's kind of hard to tell exactly what Langston's part in it is when you read it. There's just not that much evidence of Langston's work. The dialogue is very clearly Zora's. The plot is very clearly Zora's. The characters are all people that Zora knew in Edenville. So it's a little bit difficult to see where Langston's part is, but he did contribute some things. He definitely, I had the idea of setting the third act on a railroad track. He did change one of the main motives of the plot to some degree. Anyway, they collaborated on it and they worked together with this young woman named Louise Thompson, who was their stenographer. Louise is a fascinating character in her own right. There's even been a book written about her recently. But suffice it to say that she and Langston became very close, very intimate. Probably didn't have a physical relationship, but she was deeply in love with him. And Zora began to get a little jealous. Now, Langston made a few moves at this point while they were collaborating on the play that were not really great moves. One was to tell Mason about the play, and she blew up. Another was to suggest that that Louise deserved some credit for the play, which really angered Zora because Louise was just the typist. And then a third was a little bit later, showing the play without Zora's permission to a white regional theater producer in Pennsylvania, which totally went against Zora's idea of making this a Broadway production. And so Zora distanced herself from Langston at that point. And then in early 1931, the play found its way to Cleveland, where Langston was living at that point. He had broken up with Mason. And and the Karamu Theater in Cleveland was going to make a big production of the play. And when Zora found out about it, she was mad because, and when Langston found out it, he was mad because he was mad because Zora had taken his name off the play, and Zora was mad because she had wanted it to be a Broadway production, not a regional production in Cleveland. And they corresponded a lot. They spoke a lot on the phone. They had some rapprochement. You know, they had moments where everything was fine. They were going to make up. They were going to get back together and do this play right. And then they had moments where they were threatening each other with lawsuits. And it became extremely emotional, extremely tense. And in the end, Zora went to Cleveland and made a huge scene and prevented the play, which had already been in production, from going on stage. And that was the end of it. And after that, over decades, Zora's and Langston's relationship, Zora and Langston, I mean, there was this kind of tension in their relationship, which was not close at all. Zora told Arna Bontemps that the cross of her life was that the relationship had come apart. Langston was very condescending about Zora in his autobiography. So Zora responded by leaving Langston out of her autobiography altogether. She even wrote a whole long chapter on friendship in which she named all of her friends and left Langston out. There were catty things going on between them. Like, Zora would talk about Langston as the worst kind of communist to major white publications. So, you know, this enmity lasted to the end of their lives, really. So it's a bitter ending.
Yeah, where do you think this kind of fits in the pantheon of feuds, literary or otherwise?
No, I think it's high up there. I mean, a number of African American writers have called it the greatest literary feud in African American history. So, yeah, it's up there.
Yeah, and you know, thank you so much, Yuval, for giving us that run through. It's so funny to me too, because I didn't learn any of those things about the feud when I was in college taking these classes. Really, your book was the first time I got to get into that. And it's just interesting how there's this entire narrative of drama that, you know, I think people, writers now who have that kind of drama today, that drama will follow them because of, you know, social media. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But it's just fascinating because that just didn't get lost, but it definitely doesn't come, you know, it's not information we get that often in classes. So thank you.
No, you're welcome.
Yeah. And one of the things that really struck me about your book were just the artistic differences between the two of them that you get into. Zora condemned Black writers, you say, who made suffering the focus of their work, while Langston's, of course, known, you know, for his political work. I think at some point everyone has read I Too, his politically charged response to Walt Whitman's poem, I Hear America Singing. And he describes his own experiences as the darker brother. So I was just wondering, can you say a little bit more about their approaches to writing about Black people and why they might have taken such different approaches?
Sure. I mean, they shared, as I said before, they shared an aesthetic in common in the 1920s. And they were very, they loved each other's work back then. And they were both writing the same kind of work in many ways, because they were placing a great deal of emphasis on African-American folklore. And, you know, Langston's second book of poems, Fine Clothes to the Jew, is just almost all blues lyrics. And Zora would read that book aloud to the people in the South that she was trying to get folk stories from. So there was this great connection. I think where they really split was when Langston joined the Communist Party in 1931. And Zora became later in life an arch conservative, Republican, very, very anti-communist. And she even opposed integration by the end of her life. So there was a very, very strong ideological difference between them. But even in the 1920s, there was this idea, as you said, that Zora really didn't want to hear any kind of sobbing stories from African-American writers or from African-Americans in general. She felt that that resentment was a dead end road, that political action, great, fine, but complaining about wrongs, painting yourself as a victim was just the worst thing you could do. It robbed you of dignity, and it was exactly what the oppressors wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, Langston had a very different idea. You know, Langston wanted to expose the injustices that African Americans faced in the South. He was always involved in politics to some degree. Whereas Zora felt like that stuff was just was just too easy. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually have a quote from your book that really, you know, brings it home. Zora recognized that those who are bitter and resentful are seen by themselves and others as victims, and the very existence of victims justifies in a real way the acts of the victimizers. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think of, you know, the conservative party, you know, and also Black conservatives. I've heard this narrative as well, you know, that if you play the victim, you're kind of falling into this pattern.
Right.
Yeah. And it's difficult to imagine Zora Neale Hurston's philosophy of not wanting to point out racial injustice in her work being celebrated by Black Twitter today. That's something I've been thinking about, especially in 2020, given the year we had. How might you, and you got into this a little bit, but how might you contextualize Zora Neale Hurston's stance on not wanting to write about these things for someone who might be, you know, confused or dismissive of her stance today?
Well, it changed and it is inconsistent, because she did address injustice in her writings for Negro World. And she did talk about what white publishers don't want to print. I mean, that's the title of one of her essays, I think. She railed against what she called the sobbing school of Negro writers. She, at the same time, she was forthright about criticizing prejudice and injustice. I think the line that she drew was not like, let's not criticize white people. It's let's not complain about the way we were treated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a line that many of the Black Lives Matter people are on Zora's side. I mean, they are taking extremely concrete action to change the way African Americans are treated. And they're having a great impact. They've made so much progress. And it reminds me of Zora's quote, you know, about, I can't remember the exact words, but something about, I don't want to complain, I just want to sharpen my oyster knife, you know?
So good.
You know, while Zora's later writings certainly do fall into the very conservative end of things, you know, when she decries integration, for example, she was very much upset about Brown versus Board of Ed. But you have to see it also that she was fundamentally a Black separatist. She grew up in an all-Black town, while she catered to white to a white audience very much, and it was very important to her to have a white audience. Her own belief was that Blacks could only find self-worth through identifying as Black. And the same thing was what Langston felt. Langston felt that they were in complete agreement on that part of things. So Black identity was extremely important to both of them. They weren't in any way assimilationist, which is what many of the conservative African-American thinkers have been, you know, since even before Booker T. Washington. So it's important that that we keep in mind that Zora wasn't conservative in that sense. It was just more politically conservative.
An important distinction, definitely.
So as you mentioned, both were pretty vocal in their grievances with each other after their fallout. Speaking of social media, what method of social media, if any, do you think they would be likely to be using today?
That's hard to say. I mean, that, you know, they were using whatever media they had at the time. So, excuse me, they were phoning each other, they were sending each other telegrams, and they were writing each other letters all at the same time on the same day, you know. And Zora would be writing 3 or 4 letters per day to Langston at the very end when they were having their big dust up. And then she would go to Langston, and then she went to Cleveland and visited him. I mean, so communication for them was like by any means necessary. You know, so that's kind of how I feel that they'd be using social media today.
All of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they'd have any hesitation about it. Nothing was, I never got the sense that any form of writing or communication was beneath them, you know. And Zora would go on to contribute pieces for such a wide variety of publications, from all Black publications like Negro World to Saturday Evening Post, you know, just all white publications. So she was, and you could say the same thing for Langston too, because he was writing for Communist Party vehicles like New Masses, but then when he got a chance, he would write for New York newspapers, you know. So I think communication by any means necessary.
I have another question that might be a little tricky to answer. So Zora Neale Hurston, of course, died without a grave marker, while Langston Hughes's ashes were interred in the Schomburg, which is incredible. I'm wary of applying today's norms to yesterday, so to speak, but how much would you say the differences in their treatment have to do with sexism, if you'd say sexism had any impact at all?
I think it's a huge, huge factor. Absolutely. I mean, Zora's treatment at the hands of African-American male writers is just abominable. And there's so much condescension going on, just so much condescension. And they totally failed to understand her in many ways. They accused her of playing to the white folks. That was their big cudgel. But behind that was a lot of sexism. Zora was very, very concerned with the ways of Black women, you know. That was what her central subject was. And the male writers who read her didn't have that much interest in that. I think that's sexism is just a huge, huge big part of the story of the reasons why they ended up their lives in such different places. But also there's politics, you know.
Right.
Langston was on the winning side in terms of African-American literary culture. And Zora was really at the margins because she basically lost all her Black friends. And her politics were odious to African-Americans by the end of her life.
What do you think this whole ordeal and their falling out tell us about the nature of collaboration? I mean, you mentioned how hard it is to know, you know, which parts are Langston's if any, you know, is just his presence part of that collaboration, their chemistry together? What do you think this shows us about the nature of collaborating?
I think collaboration is tough. Friendships are very tough. And collaborations can turn friendships very sour. And there's the, I think there, the problem is that the differences between people get heightened when they collaborate, you know, it's just inevitable. And the conflicts between them get heightened because of the questions of who's going to be taking the credit and who's going to be reaping the benefits of the fame as a result of the collaboration. I have, I'm fascinated by collaboration because, and one of the things I've done is I've collaborated on two books, you know, and I've collaborated with a writer named Hugh Barker on my book, Faking It, The Quest for Authenticity in Popular Music. And then I collaborated with the Chicago writer, Jake Austin, on Darkest America, Black Minstrelsy from Slavery to Hip Hop. And those were both successful and we didn't have falling outs and everything went well. But when collaboration is, when collaboration happens with someone with whom you're very intimate, it I think is more likely to turn sour. And right now I'm writing another book about a pair of collaborators, musicians, Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham. And they, and that relationship.
Sounds great.
That relationship is really.
We both got very excited.
Yeah, I can see. And that, okay. That relationship is something else, you know.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So. That sounds amazing. Well, the thing too is like, while reading this, I was thinking about a time in college when an instructor had my entire class write an essay together mm-hmm. on Google Docs as the final paper. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that was in itself a struggle, and that's, you know, having Google. Whereas I can't imagine collaborating at a time where, again, there's like no timestamps in the way mm-hmm. that we have them. And yeah, there's so much a gray area. And I think you really bring that part home about just how messy, for lack of a better word,
yes, very messy
yeah. It was, and then how it was handled afterwards.
Yeah, it became so messy because also, you know, there was this weird dynamic with Charlotte Mason too, where right. she was controlling Zora's work, and Zora was showing her work to Langston without her permission, and Langston was trying to keep that secret from Mason. So was Zora. And then they were collaborating on the Mule Bone without her permission and trying to keep that secret. It gets very, very messy. Very messy.
Yeah. And actually that leads into my next question, which mm-hmm. is, this book made me consider the question of what it means to be an artist when you're getting paid to fulfill someone else's vision, which mm-hmm. most writers, you know, any artist really can understand that struggle. Can you say a little bit about when Charlotte Osgood Mason's participation, I need a better word. I mean, she's pulling the strings, right?
So patronage, yeah.
Patronage, yeah. When that became public, and also just can you say a little bit more about her for listeners who might not really know her deal?
I don't know that it became public until the 70s. Because she tried to keep it a total secret, and she wouldn't allow any of her patrons to use her name. She really wanted to remain anonymous, to her credit. And okay, so she was this very wealthy white woman who had this belief that primitive cultures, and those are you know, I'm not saying that they're primitive, but she would say that they're primitive. They're the cultures of African Americans and of American Indians and of Africans. Could wipe away the evils of civilization and bring the world back to a more Edenic state. And she had, prior to bankrolling a number of Harlem Renaissance writers, many years before that, she had helped a woman named Natalie Curtis investigate the ways of African of American Indians. She had actually gone with Curtis to the Southwest and spent time with Indians, and had helped Curtis publish the Indian Book, which was this foundational tome of American Indian folklore. She had already gotten really involved in this whole idea of channeling the primitive, and bringing these indigenous folkways to light. So it made sense for her to start bankrolling Zora, especially because Zora was involved in the same kind of thing with documenting African American folktales and folklore. But she had a very she had this really weird racial complex, I guess you'd call it, where she considered herself Black, where she dismissed a number of African American intellectuals as being too white, and she also had this. There was also a very religious aspect to her. She believed in telepathy and all sorts of extrasensory perception type stuff. Past live regression for sure. And she inspired this wild devotion from her acolytes, this religious devotion. Many, many people who just met her just once or twice felt this aura emanating from her and felt this complete awe of her. She had this amazing charisma. And Zora and Langston were certainly two of her strongest acolytes. Zora's letters to her are like letters to a goddess. Mm-hmm. For Langston, it was the most emotional and intense relationship of his entire life. And when their relationship ended, he suffered terribly. He had a complete nervous breakdown, and actually fell physically extremely ill. It was an extremely intense relationship, and Mason was very controlling and very jealous and needed to be constantly praised and needed to be constantly thanked, and any hint of ingratitude would send her into a fury. And she was very controlling. She insisted on knowing how her acolytes spent every penny she gave them, and she wanted records of everything they ate. She even wanted records of their bowel movements. It's a very strange relationship. Very, very strange and very hard to comprehend. But it is in line with the way cult figures, the way cult religious figures dominate the lives of their acolytes, and I would suggest that Charlotte Mason was in a way a cult leader.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Jennifer brought up this really excellent point when we were talking about your book a few days ago, just like the fact that she didn't want credit is so fascinating. Like you usually expect the person to really want, like, part of the reason why they're doing these things is for like the public nature of it all, but it says something different about her.
No, she really did not want credit at all. She wanted to remain this anonymous donor. And her interest, I think it's in keeping with her interest in focusing on the primitive. You know, she knew that she was a wealthy socialite, you know, and that her involvement would tarnish the way the artistic production of these people would look, if it were brought to light.
Yeah.
And the other thing about the patronage that you can't ignore is the amount of money that she gave, and that was a lot. I mean, it's equivalent to $750,000 in today's money, or maybe $1 million to all the various African Americans that she supported. And this was during the height of the Depression, and Mason had lost a third of her savings in the Depression, and she still continued to be extremely generous. And so you had Langston being chauffeured by a white limo driver while all his friends were on the street, you know, trying to scrounge up some food to eat. Very, very dramatic and conflicting situation. Yeah.
Just fascinating. So we have a bit of a lightning round for you now to wrap things up, where we just want to ask you about some preferences that, to imagine some preferences they might have if they were with us today in a modern setting. So,
okay.
All right. So our first lightning round question is, podcasts or TV, which would they be most likely to binge?
Podcasts.
Yeah. Both of them.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Next one. This is multiple options here. Paperback, hardcover, audio, or ebook?
I think audio.
Interesting. Why is that?
They both liked the spoken word very, very much. I mean, Langston was, his whole aesthetic in his poetry was declamation, you know, and he starts his autobiography with throwing all his books into the water, into the ocean. You know, so he's got this anti-literary bent, you know, he just wants everything that he wrote was meant to be declaimed. And unfortunately, he wasn't a good reader of his own poetry. But if you listen to, I mean, the best thing is when you listen to Martin Luther King read Mother to Son. I mean, that is just unbelievable. And you really get a sense of the power of Langston's words when you hear that. The audio is great.
All right. Would they use Spotify or purchase all of their music on vinyl?
I think Langston might be more inclined to do vinyl. Zora might be more inclined to use Spotify. You have to remember that Zora was broke and Langston had a little bit of cash. And vinyl's not cheap anymore.
No.
Makes sense. We're all rebuying all of our old stuff on vinyl these days. So last one, Tyler Perry or Spike Lee, which director would they be more likely to collaborate with?
Langston, definitely Spike Lee. Zora, I think possibly Tyler Perry.
Interesting. I like it.
Yeah. I mean, because Tyler Perry has much more of a focus on women and he's playing to white people, which Zora loved to do, you know, and he's more focused on comedy. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much.
This you're welcome.
Fascinating. Thank you for the wonderful book and for the discussion today.
Oh, you're welcome. This was a lot of fun. Thanks.